This is episode number 780 of the Secret Identity podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Wonder Woman conquering the box office, HasCon coming in September, and the Inkwell Awards. Our comics this week will be Generation X number 1, Detective Comics number 957, and Giant Days number 26. And our BoobTube and Big Screen Bonanza is coming back today with our discussion of Wonder Woman.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letenry here with the always beautiful, the always talented, the covered in Ernie.
Covered
Matthew
in Ernie.
Herring. I almost said Bert, but it's an Ernie shirt that you're rocking today.
I got the Ernie.
Yeah, very nice. So is that an 80s tee shirt?
No, this is one that I think I got somewhere for like $4 or $5.
Huh.
And then just chopped off the sleeves and became a summer shirt.
Yeah, I mean, if I spoke about the sleeves, I would literally every episode be saying the sleeveless
yes.
Matthew A. Herring. There are more days that you are sleeveless than sleeved.
Yes, and there's more days that you bring your iPad to record than not bring your iPad.
I think this was the first time ever
yep.
that I have come here, and I rarely come here directly from work, only if like I'm working right up until the time I need to get over here. So today, I loaded up the old backpack with everything. I had my tablet that I have my comics on. I had the actual physical comics that I have. I got my Judge Dredd book. I've got all my notes. I'm ready to roll. I've got the connectors for the mixing board, all that stuff. One problem.
No iPad.
No iPad.
If I was going to go into the woods with somebody, I would go with you because you have that backpack full of everything that we need.
Except the one thing.
Except the one thing
that brings
we
it all together.
It.
So I had to run home to grab it. So you know what, Matt? It just makes it that much sweeter when we get to sit down and talk about the stuff that we love. And we're going to talk about something that we haven't even spoke about yet, but I'm going to assume that we both absolutely loved. I think we're on the same page about Wonder Woman.
Yes.
And we'll get into the Wonder Woman talk a little more in depth when we get into our BoobTube and Big Screen, but you know, we certainly want to talk about this past weekend's box office, right? Because that's always the big question anytime a superhero movie comes out. How's it going to do?
Yes.
How's it going to stack up against other superhero movies? Is it going to make its money back? Is this going to flop? That kind of stuff. I don't think there was any concern that Wonder Woman was going to flop, but there were questions.
There's always the worry because you know what? You can make your money like Batman v Superman did. But then you also have a lot of the baggage that goes with it.
Sure.
So you're hoping it's going to make the money without the baggage.
And the news this week, I pulled a bunch of stories off of ICV2. So thanks to them. It says, Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman broke all kinds of gender-based records with a rip-roaring North American debut estimated at $100.5 million. That's just in the U.S. There's no doubt Wonder Woman's debut set new records, both domestic and global, for the size of a debut film from a woman director. I'm a little bit disappointed that all of the press about this movie is about they have to mention that it's a woman director.
It's a woman director. It's a woman character. I'm the exact same way.
And
it has been driving me nuts.
And I'm disappointed that that even has to be discussed
mm-hmm.
because the fact of the matter is Patty Jenkins probably directed, if not my favorite superhero movie, my 1A superhero movie. And we'll talk about that when we get into that. But I don't like that they keep framing her as the woman director.
Yes.
Or that a woman. Why is that a surprise? The only surprise is that there are not enough women directors that have been given the opportunity to actually direct these movies.
Yeah.
Or you would be hearing more of these stories.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's going back to like the 70s when every Marvel character that was black was the Black Goliath, the Black Panther. We know they're black.
Well,
we don't have to have
but
black
it's the same thing with
name.
Like, you know, and Wonder Woman had a great, you know, a female-led superhero movie. Yes, the only people that didn't think that was going to happen were the studio executives
yes.
who took so long to let Wonder Woman, you know, have her own movie, who haven't done a Black Widow movie yet. Because the fans and the comic readers and everybody else, they know that Wonder Woman is one of the Trinity. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, so that, it just kind of irks me a little bit when every news story is framed in that way. Because the other piece of that is that, forget, I'm sure Patty Jenkins would rather you give credit to the fact that Wonder Woman was a fantastically directed movie and that she, as a director, made an incredible movie.
We know Patty's a woman. Great movie. Talk about the movie.
Right. So let's talk about the movie. In addition to its $100.5 million domestic bow, Wonder Woman earned $122.5 million overseas for current global cum of $223 million in its first weekend, meaning that in just 3 days, Wonder Woman has earned more than Warner Brothers' expensive Green Lantern film took in during its entire global run.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
The first 3 days, it destroyed Green Lantern. By next weekend, Wonder Woman will have earned more than any other DC Comics film that does not feature either Batman or Superman, not adjusting for inflation. Maybe even more importantly is the 93% positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes and the solid A cinema score from opening weekend audiences. Wonder Woman has recaptured the cachet of quality that made Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy so potent at the box office. Wonder Woman is the first film in Warner Brothers' extended DC cinematic universe to win over both critics and audiences, and she has single-handedly revived a sinking franchise that was mired in its own cinematic gloom. They go on to say a bunch of other stuff. But the important thing to note there is that Wonder Woman had a fantastic opening weekend and, in the eyes of many, was the DC movie that they were waiting for in terms of tone. Mm. And I know that there are plenty of defenders of the other DC movies. I'm sure our good buddy Daryl Taylor will chime in at any point now and let us know that Batman versus Superman is one of his favorite films of all time. But there are a lot of people nonetheless out there who felt like the first entries in this shared cinematic universe have been less than stellar.
Yep.
And almost everyone that has seen Wonder Woman has said that this is the one that has turned that around.
Yep. And I'm not going to say anything else about it until we talk about the movie.
We will talk about it in a few minutes. So other stuff going on. I didn't know if you knew this, Matthew, but ending a year of speculation, Hasbro has announced that it will host HasCon, its own fan convention, September 8th through 10th, 2017. That's happening this September.
I heard that on the radio. WEEI had a radio commercial for it.
The event will be held in Hasbro's hometown, Providence, Rhode Island. Hasbro has made moves towards such an event when it reserved several marks last year, including HasCon and HasbroCon. Let's see. The event will feature previews of Hasbro's TV shows and movies, so lots of G.I. Joe and Transformers, Hasbro gaming competitions, and exclusive products, the company said, all around Hasbro's brands, including My Little Pony, Magic the Gathering, Transformers, G.I. Joe, and more. I forgot that Hasbro owns Wizards of the Coast, yes. So they also have D&D in there as well. President of Hasbro Brands, John Frassati, described the event, HasCon will deliver an extraordinary peek behind the curtain of our brands, storytelling, and iconic characters, while giving us the opportunity to invite fans and families to our hometown for the most memorable, unified Hasbro experience ever, he said, Matthew.
Is it going to be held at the Dunk?
Oh, I don't know if it's going to be held at the Dunk or not, but it doesn't say here where it's going to be held, but I know that you can go there, and tickets were a little bit pricey. I think it was like $35 for a day and like $150 for the weekend. Actually, I don't know how that compares to other shows, but I didn't realize it was happening so soon.
Yeah.
It's happening in September, and it didn't say anything about press or any of that other stuff on there. But that's a show that I would be interested in checking out.
We definitely should plan on it one way or another, because Rhode Island's only an hour and half. Hour,
even for a day,
minutes,
just going down like and seeing like if they're doing gaming events, if they're doing, you know, previews of toys and movies and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of Hasbro properties we're interested in.
Yep. And I got a new car that is looking to make some
serious
drives.
You have a great
drives.
New car. You have a new Hyundai Elantra.
It's a Sonata.
Oh, it's a Sonata.
Yeah, I went up a level.
Yeah. Actually, that makes sense now, because it is bigger than the Elantra is like one size down.
Yes.
And that's what I've driven forever.
And this almost feels like a boat to me.
Yeah, well, what's the one up from that?
There's the Sonata. Santa Fe? No, that's
the SUV.
Yeah.
In any case, it's a great new car.
Yes, thank you.
It's quite a change from the PT Cruiser era of Matthew Herring,
yes.
Which has been the last like
four or five years at least.
Yeah, at least 4 or 5 years. So that's a nice switch. There's also a great story about Wonder Woman I will link to, which I'm not going to read the whole story here, but there is a story about one of the women who played one of the Amazons, Artemis, who played Artemis in the movie. She is a boxer by the name of Ann Wolfe. And there is a great article on theringer.com about her, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, and the life that she has had both inside of boxing and out of boxing, because she's sort of a boxing legend, and now she's a boxer training legend, one of the toughest people on the face of the planet.
Wow.
And there is a video in this particular article that shows like her most famous fight, because she was one of the most powerful female boxers back before female boxing really became big, and back before MMA became big. So now you have people like Ronda Rousey getting $3 million a fight or something like that. This was like a $30,000 fight that she was a part of, but she was facing like an undefeated fighter, and the right hook that she knocks this woman out with one punch just absolutely destroyed her. And she is one of many, basically a whole bunch of the Amazons on Wonder Woman were, well-known female athletes from all different walks of life, from boxing, from, you know, particular sports, from CrossFit, from all this kind of stuff that they recruited for this movie. And a lot of that was Patty Jenkins basically saying, I want to be as authentic as possible in this movie. I want to go out and get people. So there were specific people that she was thinking of that she wanted in the movie, and Ann Wolfe was one of them. And Ann Wolfe's story is just amazing. So I'll put a link in the show notes so you can go and read that. And the last piece of news that we have this week, Matthew, is about the Inkwell Awards.
Yes.
Which, of course, we have been affiliated with since the beginning.
Yep.
Results from the 10th annual Inkwell Awards will be presented at the Inking Advocacy Group's 7th Live Awards Ceremony at Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina. The ceremony is scheduled for Friday, June 16th, which, as you listen to this, I believe is this weekend, because I think this will go up on Friday. So it'll be this weekend at the Charlotte Convention Center in room 209-210. Golden Silver Age Ink artist and famed DC Comics mainstay Joe Gaiella is scheduled to appear as a guest of honor. Golden Age and Timely pioneer and penciler and inker Alan Bellman will also act as a guest speaker for one of the two special recognition award recipients. So if you are going to Heroes Con, room 209 to 210, 5 p.m. Friday, June 16th, that is going to be the Inkwell Awards ceremony. And so the votes are in.
The legends that they have there, those two names, are two of the biggest names in comic book history as far as inking goes. And Joe Gaiella has, I mean, if I look at my collection, he's probably touched probably 10,000 of the comics that I have in here. He's just amazing. And it is so cool that Bob is still just waving that flag, but now, you know, the old guard is really helping out to really further this. And that's great.
And if you're going to be there, the first 25 non-member attendees will receive a raffle ticket for an automatic door prize, which I'm just going to assume is some ridiculously amazing piece of artwork.
Yep.
Bob said, we've had record attendance for the past couple of years and plan to repeat that achievement, especially with our impressive lineup and prizes. The Inkwells will be set up in Artist Alley as of yet unspecified location, to be announced soon at the Heroes Con website. So not only will they be having the ceremony, but the Inkwell Awards group will be there all weekend in Artist Alley, so you can go over and probably meet and talk to some of the nominees, some of the recipients, and of course Bob, who is just the ambassador for inkers in the industry. And so we want to congratulate them, congratulate all the winners, even though we don't even know who they are yet, because these guys will be announced and gals will be announced on Friday the 16th. So I'll make sure that our show goes up at the very latest on Friday morning, so that if you're listening to this on your way to Heroes Con, then you will know where to go. But I'm sure they'll do a great job of advertising it. And there's more details about this on the Secret Identity website. So there you go. That's our news, Matthew. And it's about time for us to get into comics. But before we do, I want to acknowledge our sponsor, who is Viking Oils. And if you go to VikingOilsLLC.com, you can see some of their new seasonal beard products, including the Woods Fest, which is what I now have, thanks to Gary and thanks to you. I used every last ounce of the last beard oil that I had, and this came just in time.
Yeah.
Just in time to save my beard, or I would have had to consider shaving it. because it would have started to really irritate me.
And the bottles that they come in are so cool, and I can almost picture you like with a Q-tip just trying to get that last drop out, trying to find it, reaching underneath.
I think he puts at least in the last one, I think he puts coffee beans in the bottom of them.
Yes.
And so that was literally all that was – I was going to have to like take the coffee beans out and roll them around in my beard in order to get the product in there. But yes, when I came home and saw those, I was super psyched for that. So.
And with Father's Day coming, there's going to be a lot of deals on the website. We are going to have some promo codes, so we will be sending things out. We'll be putting them on the Facebook page. You'll put them on yours. We'll put them on anything that we are attached to. We will put promo codes up there for Father's Day for discounts and great things, because if you've got a dad and he's got a beard – you don't want him going to do – you don't want him sucking on coffee beans like Brian almost was.
Yeah, you don't want people walking around with coffee beans in their beard. You know what I mean? Unless it's a fashion statement.
Yes, that could be next.
Not to make their beard more luscious. So there you go. Go to VikingOilsLLC.com. Check out the new seasonal products and, you know – we are customers. So
yes,
I can vouch for their efficacy, because without them, I was in trouble.
And without them, I am – always looking to shave. Yep. Now I'm not so much wanting to shave.
All righty. Well, let's get into comics, Matthew. And I'm going to start us off this week with Generation X number one. Now, I collected Generation X back in the 90s. And I would say outside of my 2099 collecting, the Generation X book was probably the one comic that I had the most complete run of. And I can't remember if I had them all and – or I was missing like one or two. I think I might have been missing one or two, and I went back and subsequently got them when we started doing this podcast.
Yep.
So I believe I have the full run of the original Generation X. And so as someone, again, who every time the X-Men sort of reboot looks for that way in, I saw Generation X was happening, and I saw that Jubilee was going to be a primary character in the new Generation X. I said, sign me up. I'm going to check it out. And a lot's happened with Jubilee over the past several years, some of it which I did not even know. So this is the new Generation X book, and it starts off with Jubilee in Central Park in New York City. And she is running around looking for her son, Shogo, because she has a child now.
I didn't know she had a child.
And she's running around, and she still has a yellow coat on, but it's not the long yellow raincoat that she used to wear back in the day. It's more of a shorter look now, but she's unmistakably Jubilee, and she's running around looking for her son, and she's talking and she's saying, I think I get it now why people buy their kids those cute little backpacks with the leashes on them. You know, not that I'd actually do that. And she says, right, Jono? And she turns around and it is Chamber from the original Generation X guys, who was the guy who always wore like a scarf over his face.
Because his mouth would have the fire in it.
His mouth has basically, it's just like energy.
Yep.
And so he's there. So right off the bat, I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. And he's like, calm down. I'm sure he's around somewhere. I'm sure you'll find him. And sure enough, she does. And when she scoops up her little boy, you know, he kind of reaches in to say something to the kid, and the kid pulls his scarf down. So of course, the energy that is the lower half of his face is like all over the place. And Jubilee kind of scolds him because she sort of exposed him out in the middle of everybody. And he's like, don't worry about it, you know, and they just have a quick conversation and then he sort of leaves. And I don't know if that's the only cameo we're going to get from the original crew of Generation X in there, but it was nice in any case to have that sort of passing of the torch moment of seeing him there. And so she ends up running over to the Xavier Institute, which has now been relocated to Central Park. So not only is the Xavier Institute in Central Park now a place where young mutants will come to get their education and to learn how to control their powers and all that kind of stuff, but it is also kind of this embassy for people to learn more about mutants, for there to be more. It's almost like what was happening in the Aquaman comics when they first started, you know, having that place where humans and non-humans alike can come and learn about each other and sort of bridge that gap and all that kind of stuff. And you see there's tours going on and there's new students coming in. And the first student coming in is he's wearing gloves. So you see this kid coming in, his hair is kind of silver, a little bit like Quicksilver's, and he's walking in and he's carrying a suitcase, but he's wearing gloves. And as he's walking along, he is looking at all of the new students that are signing up and coming in to register and all this kind of stuff. And he ends up bumping into this young woman. And when he does, he had taken his glove off for some reason, or she didn't have gloves on and she touched his arm and she activated his power. And you see that who this kid is a mutant who can see the past of people that they touch. So he's kind of has that rogue thing of like, as soon as he touches someone, something happens. And in this case, it's he gets visions of their past. And so he finds out that she is one of the cuckoos, Phoebe, I believe her name is. And so he saw her whole history, which I guess they're clones of Emma Frost. Is that
– I think that's what it is. They look like little Emmas.
Yeah. So he sort of sees her whole past. And his name is Nathaniel Carter. And so she's like, all right, where are you supposed to be? She's kind of annoyed with him, but she's kind of pointing him in the right direction of where he needs to go. And she introduces him to one of his classmates, Benjamin Deeds. So you're presuming that this is another kid who you're going to see become one of the main characters of this, you know, thing. But I don't really know anybody yet as we're going in. And then it cuts back to Jubilee, and Jubilee goes in to meet with Kitty Pryde, who is now like the headmaster of this school. And it sounds like she's brought Jubilee in to be one of the teachers at this new Xavier, you know, Institute. And so they're sitting there talking. And at one point, Jubilee reaches into her bag to grab a sippy cup for her son. And it's a sippy cup full of blood because it's her sippy cup because she's a vampire.
I forgot about her being a vampire.
And that's when you're reminded that she is, in fact, a vampire. And I think that that happened, I want to say, about 5 years ago or something
like
that.
Yeah, it was one of the events when there was a like the vampires were coming in.
Yeah, and it was around the time of the last relaunch of the X-Force yes. that was happening where they were all wearing the black and gray uniforms and stuff like that, because I remembered her showing up and becoming a vampire. So she is, in fact, a vampire, and apparently she doesn't have her fireworks powers anymore. But she's a vampire, and she's going to teach at the school. And Kitty's kind of saying, geez, you got a lot on your plate. Are you sure you want to do this? And Jubilee's saying, yeah, this was – it was important to me – to find a place that I belonged and find a peer group that I could, you know, you feel comfortable around. And so I want to get back. So I sort of want to do this. And then it cuts back to Nathaniel and this other kid, Ben. And we find out that this other kid, Ben, has the ability to morph his body to mimic anybody else's. So he can make himself look like anybody else. And so those two are having a conversation when all of a sudden the wall blows out and this young woman, Roxy, comes flying in, and her skin is covered in diamonds. So she has the ability to create like this diamond skin and can shoot out projectiles from her skin and stuff like that. She's getting into a fight with this guy named Quentin Quire, who apparently is like this Omega level mutant who can has these tremendous powers. And he's been a sometimes ally and a sometimes bad guy to the mutants, but he's still a young kid. And so he is trying to sort of reform himself and is back here at the school, but he can't keep himself from getting out of getting into trouble. And so he was fighting with this young woman because she like stepped on his shoes or something like that. And they're super expensive shoes. So you could see the first day of school here turns into an absolute melee and everything is going wrong. Walls are being knocked down and Kitty is sort of responsible for keeping all of this in check. So she finally manages to calm the group down and she's, you know, scolding people and sending people in every direction. And this kid, Nathaniel, that had just come in, the one that can see people's memories and in their past, he's like, this place is too much for me. Like, I'm not going to be here. And so he ends up leaving and walking out of the place, and Jubilee ends up running after him. And they have a nice moment where Jubilee is sort of telling him, I know it's kind of all over the place right now. I know there's a lot of chaos going on right now, but trust me, I was in your spot once. I feel like this place could be good for you. I know that you're probably sick of hiding who you are and, you know, kind of running away from stuff and all that kind of stuff. Don't do that. Stay here, you know, and I think it could be a great experience for you. And she kind of has him almost convinced when somebody kind of screams, because the tour group that is being led through, a couple of people in the tour group pull guns and you see that it is members of the Purifiers who have shown up on the first day of this new school's openings. And the Purifiers are this radical group who are trying to eradicate the mutants. And so they wear shirts that have like this white cross on them. And that was another huge storyline that happened around the same time of the Purifiers showing up. I think maybe they even showed up in the Cable book that you and I had talked a lot about back then. So that's the way the first issue ends, is that there has been a major melee and now there is some sort of attack happening at the school on the very first day. So things in Central Park are not going completely smoothly for the new crew and in this new Generation X book. Now, this book is written by Christina Strain. The art is by Amilcar Pina. Colors by Felipe Sobrero. Letters by Clayton Coles. And the editor on this book is Daniel Ketchum. And so I think for a first introduction, it does a pretty good job of setting the tone of this being kind of a new beginning and you meeting some new mutants. What they don't do a great job of is making you feel like you know who people are and stuff like that. And I know we're kind of in an era now where we shy away from the idea of, you know, all the subtitles of, you know, this is Rogue, this is her power, this is Beast, this is her power. Some of that stuff happens here organically through the dialogue, but I am not at all opposed to, in a book that has an ensemble cast and multiple people with multiple powers, for you to just remind readers of that as they kind of go through the issue. So I wish they would have did a little bit more of that. That said, it definitely did enough as a first issue to make me want to come back and read the next one, because I'm a fan of Jubilee, and I'm really hoping that we see some more of the original Generation X crew, maybe even as teachers at the school.
That's a book that's been out for, I think, 3 weeks now.
I think so, yeah.
And every time I go to the store, I pick it up, look through it, go, you know what? I might get it if I don't have a lot to get. Then I put it back. This week was the closest I got. I think I'm going to go back and at least give it a try. And like you said, I used to love those days when you would get a book, and it never distracted me to have the asterisk and then at the bottom, hey, if you don't remember, Kitty or Jubilee became a vampire in X-Men Volume 10, Issue 4, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And that would give you that little bit of help. Oh, even if you weren't going to go back and look, oh, she's a vampire.
I'm a huge fan, and we've talked about this before, of the editor's notes. I'm a huge fan of the thought bubbles. Like anything that you can do to make someone picking up the book for the first time feel like they have a good idea of what's going on, do that.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to shift over to the DC Universe for Detective Comics 957, or as I like to call this issue, Brian, Jubilee Strikes. I mean, not Jubilee. Let me rephrase that one. Spoiler Strikes. Are you caught up yet?
I am not caught up, and I am ashamed of myself because this is the Stephanie Brown book, apparently, that I've been waiting for.
Yes. So we have now, with all the things that have been going on with the team that was put together in Detective Comics, this was going to be the Bat family, where Batwoman and Batman were going to get together and teach the young kids. They were going to teach Damian. They were going to teach Spoiler. They were going to teach
Clayface.
Yep. All these people were in here, and they were going to teach them. And then that started to really fall apart when Cassandra Cain's father showed his true colors and was bad, dissolved everything. Now, Spoiler, because she's upset that Robin is now dead, is kind of on the vengeful warpath, and she is going to take down everything Batman. In the last few issues, she confronted Batman by telling him, you need to stop this mission. You're hurting people. You hurt the kid that I loved. You got him killed. And Batman's like, this is a mission bigger than all of us. And all this stuff's going on. But for the most part, all you need to know is Spoiler is pissed at Batman.
Okay.
So on the roof of the Gotham City Police Department, where the Bat Signal is, there is now like this laser fence all around it. So nobody can go up there and touch it. Now, that might keep somebody out. But if not, you got Harvey Bullock there standing around, walking around it, eating a dozen donuts as he is monitoring and narrating, I've got to stand here and watch a light bulb.
I'm sure he's thrilled about that.
And as he's eating his donuts, all of a sudden, like a cockroach falls onto the box. Pretty disgusting. Then he's eating and notices as he goes to grab another one, there's a cockroach right there looking at him. He throws the box down, and it is full of cockroaches. And as he is,
that's basically my nightmare, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. Yeah. So he's starting to freak out about that. And as he is distracted by that, Spoiler gets inside the laser fencing of the bat shield. And as she is going hard at work, as Harvey is going hard at work, stepping on bugs all over the place, she's got her toolkit. She is reaching in. She is dismantling. She's trying to do some stuff. And then all
just
of a sudden,
just at least tell me they're like robot cockroaches.
No, these are real cockroaches. Ugh. This is Gotham City, home of the cockroaches. And Harvey is on the thing, on the phone, going, hey, you know what? Got a little bit of some grossness. What's going on? And they say, you got to light the signal because there's something going on right now. We need the bat. So as he goes over and pulls the lever, the bat signal explodes. And as it explodes, Stephanie is seen swooping away. And then Harvey is screaming at her, if I ever catch you, I'm going to drop you and you're going to go to jail and blah, 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 blah. And there we go. So the gunshots that we heard were at GNN, the TV station, and there's a villain called the Wrath who is in there. He's big, he's armored, he looks like Doc Doom, but the size of maybe like a Mogul.
Okay.
Or Mongol.
Mongol.
One of those guys.
I knew what you talked.
I knew who I was talking about.
Yep.
I wanted to leave the last G off for savings. So you got Mongol in there, or the last N off for savings. So he goes in there, he's got a group that are all armored, wearing machine guns, and have all this stuff. They go in and they basically commandeer the TV station. And as they are going in there, they get everybody down. There's a news program going on at the moment, and they decide that they are going to make the news. So Rath is going to go in there and say his manifesto.
Sure.
This is what I'm going to do.
I mean, that's why you break into a news station.
Yep. This is what I'm going
to
do.
I got things to say.
So you have a terrified cameraman sitting there looking at him going, we're on live in 4, 3, 2, and it's all shaky. And
did he do the last two where he just does the hand signals?
4, 3, 2, and then you don't see anything.
Okay.
Because
all right.
it's a shot of the Rath.
Yeah.
So he's talking about, hey, I'm Rath, and I've come to destroy the city. But I'm really here only to destroy one thing. And, you know, so this is what's going on. And he's like, for years I've walked among you. And then before he gets into the speech, the cameraman goes, excuse me, the broadcast isn't going out. And he knows that this is not going to go over well. So Rath looks at him and goes, you interrupted me. And he goes, fix it now. And he goes, I'm a cameraman. I don't know how to fix this. So they drag him down there and they say, every minute that we're off camera, somebody's going to get shot and killed.
Sure.
So they bring him downstairs. He's looking at all the wirings, and it's like this huge mess of wiring. It's all over the place. And as he's going in there, one of the guards looks down. He sees a beam of light and then gets clocked in the face by a grating, the piece of the grating that was there. And you see that it's Spoiler. Spoiler's in there. She takes out all the guards. And you kind of forget how strong, powerful, and good at fighting Stephanie was. I remember when she first started and she was getting beat up a little bit. But then she was training with Robin, kind of got her chops. Batman helped out. She was Robin for a little while.
Well, and training with Oracle.
And training with Oracle. So she definitely could take care of herself. And she flips on a light and looks at the guy who's trying to fix this stuff and goes, please don't kill me. I have kids. And she's like, well, then close your eyes. Think about them. Don't move. This is all going to be over soon. So she goes and leaves. And as she is in there, she's trying to access some of the cameras, the security cameras, to see what's going on, to see who's where. And as she starts to get a little bit closer, Rath is getting more pissed off because he realizes that he is not even on TV. And he's, you know, like he's planned this. This was planned to the second.
I mean, he brought a manifesto.
Yep. It's all falling apart.
And you're ruining it.
Yep. So as he starts to really think about, you know what, I think some bad things are going to happen to some people right now. All of a sudden, his suit starts to get all electrified because it's hit with a batarang, and it starts to short circuit the suit. He's laying down on the ground, and that's when Stephanie comes up and just kicks the crap out of him, beats him up while he's down, and then Bullock and the police department all kick in the door. And it's awesome. This is the best line he has ever. Hands on your head, runt. She goes, why are you arresting me? He's the one that did all this stuff. And he's like, hey, you know what? You need to put your hands on your head because you're a criminal now. You've done some bad things. You're destroying police property. You've busted up the signal, and this is not going to be good. And then she flips up, and she has a little like a gift card, and she goes, hey, if you let me go, there's a donut in it for you. And he's like, you know what? You're coming with me. Lock her up. So she starts backing closer to the door. He's like, I'm serious. If you move, I'm going to tell these guys to shoot you. You're a menace. And she pulls out a little bomb thing. She drops it. And she tells Harvey, she's sorry. As the bomb goes off, smoke goes everywhere. She escapes out the top. And this is really interesting because I thought that this story was great. And I love this one part of the story. But the next page, when she's up on the roof and she's kind of catching her breath, looking around, and then somebody off camera says, you were amazing tonight, and a hand touches her shoulder, she grabs him and flips him into the wall. Now, my first thought was, it's Calculator, her father.
Yep.
It was Calculator, Calculator Man.
I think it's the Calculator.
I thought it was him. I'm like, oh, this is going to be cool. Then you turn the page and you find out that it is Anarchy.
Oh.
Who we have not seen in an awful long time. And he said, hey, I'm here to help you. What do you got to say? So these two are now going to team up and try to – because he's got a bugaboo about Batman too. So now you're going to have two of his sort of former allies, although Anarchy was a villain for a while. Two people that know Batman very well are now fighting against him.
Hmm.
So I think that that is really just leading up to just a great, great, great series of this one. So you got James Tynion, the fourth – and I can't even read this writing. Holy cow. You got a creative team on this one. They have script in here that I can't even read.
That's what I call not great lettering then.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's What they have done is you've got the words and it has got the like layering underneath it, but it just makes it cloudy.
When it gets too fancy for you to read it, then it really isn't doing its job.
And I remember looking at this, even having trouble reading it upstairs with full light on. But it was – so it's Christopher Sabella, who is also writing it with Tynion. You've got Cayman Carnero, who's the artist on this one, who is somebody that I've never really seen much of his art and really like what I've seen. I really like the way things flow on this one. So great book, despite the fact that you can't read the creative team. If you're not reading this one, this is a great way to pick up because I think some huge things are going to be happening pretty soon.
All right, Matthew. Well, speaking of a great, great, great series, let's talk about Giant Days. I am going to keep talking about this book until everyone in the world is reading this book. It is a boombox book. It is arguably my favorite comic book series going right now. And we're going to talk about issue number 26 today. Written, created and written by John Allison, pencils by Max Sarin, inks by Liz Fleming, colors by Whitney Kogar, letters by Jim Campbell, and the editors are Shannon Waters and Jasmine Amiri. This book is a freaking joy to read. Hmm. We have you have a group of guys and a group of girls who are in their second year, I believe, of university. And this book is essentially just about their day-to-day lives. And it's freaking awesome. So we open up with Daisy, who is sort of the Girl Scout of the girls' side of the group. And she is talking to Ed, who is kind of the nerdy, not world-wise one of the guys' group. And so they're living in two separate houses, but they're friends because they all used to live in the dorm together and be on campus together. And they're kind of walking and she's saying, Ed, you know, I know things living with Dean are bad, but now Dean is one of Ed's roommates. And he says, do you know, Daisy, do you know he's a foodie now? Do you know he's into all this food stuff now? And I have to carry around a plate for myself because he's using everything in the house and whatever he's doing in there, he has to use every single dish in the kitchen. So this immediately just brought me back to the days of having to live with other people and having roommates both in college and after college and just the day-to-day annoyances sometimes of living with other people, even if you have a great situation. In this case, they don't. It's him and another guy who are living with a third person who is a complete jerk, but they help pay the rent. And so you're kind of in one of those situations. And so this guy, Dean, is a real jerk who is obnoxious and is always sort of taking advantage of them and all this kind of stuff. And it's to the point where Ed doesn't even want to go home anymore. He doesn't even want to go back to the apartment that they're renting. And Daisy's like, oh, look up there, McGraw, who's their third roommate. He's just looking out the window, staring contemplatively out there like, you should relax like he does. Well, you find out why he's doing that a little bit while later. But Ed manages to go into the house, and as soon as he does, and I'll show you, Matthew, there are toxic fumes that are all throughout the apartment that he is, like, holding his breath. He's like, what is that smell? There's not even space left for air in here. And he goes into the kitchen, and this guy, Dean, who is now wearing, like, a kimono and a man bun, and he's got a medical mask on. He's saying, what is going on in here? And Dean's saying, oh, it's a minor sauerkraut incident. Nothing, you know, nothing to be worried about. The whole batch went bad. Don't worry about it, but I can fix it. He goes upstairs and he sees that McGraw, the reason that he was leaning out the window is because that's the only way for him to get fresh air. And so the two of them are basically talking about how this guy is just ruining their lives. And McGraw is saying, well, I think he has a girlfriend now. And Ed's like, yeah, but that's not necessarily going to solve the problem. He's like, you have a girlfriend. And in fact, why are you even still here right now? And he's like, well, I got in an argument with my girlfriend. And McGraw is the type of guy where he is a very he likes to build stuff. He likes to craft stuff. He is very nerdy about things that no one else cares about. And you find out that the reason that he's hanging out at their apartment is that the fight that he had with his girlfriend was about how the British electric plug system is the best in all of the world. And he and his girlfriend, there's a scene of his girlfriend saying, it's meaningless. Stop trying to prove this. That's the kind of stuff that he talks about and he gets worried about. So their personalities are just absolutely great. But what the whole issue ends up being about is they find out that this guy, Dean, has a girlfriend and he met her in the equivalent of World of Warcraft. And so the two of them have fallen in love online and Dean has asked her to come and visit him in real life. And so this is the issue where his girlfriend comes to see him. And when she does, She is completely smitten with him, very attractive young woman, but it's clear immediately that he's in over his head. And so now the other two roommates, McGraw and Ed, are like, this is fantastic. Like, she's completely got him like wrapped around her finger and life is better for us and all this other kind of stuff. But the girls are starting to notice that this relationship is not good for Dean, even though they don't like him. So you have Esther, who works at the comic book shop, and you would appreciate this scene, Matt, because she got this job at the comic shop because this jerk, Dean, is a comic book nerd, and he explained all this stuff to her before she went for her interview, so she nailed her interview.
Nice.
So she's there, but she has really not a deep knowledge of comics. And so when people come into the store, she, as she's learning stuff, she starts messing with people. So there's this guy buying his comics, and she's like, you know, I think you'll find that Galactica 80 is the best Galactica of all. And, you know, the Ronald D. Moore reboot just didn't have the educational content of Galactica 80.
Perfect.
And the guy's like, you're joking, right? And she's like, why would I joke about something as important as education for children? They're our future. And she's like, you know, it's the only show to ever be canceled because it was making the other shows on the network look bad.
Oh, my God.
And so this guy who's picking up his books is just like, doesn't even know what to say to her about that. And the guy who owns the store is like, you know, you really shouldn't tease the customers like that. And she's like, I know, but I'm going to keep doing that. So that gives you an idea of what Esther's all about. Well, anyways, Dean and his girlfriend come into the store and buy a bunch of comics. And that's when Esther sees this girl for the first time. And she realizes, I don't know if this is good for Dean. So everyone else is happy watching Dean get into this relationship too far. Dean ends up having to sell off his comic book collection in order to buy things for his girlfriend. And Esther knows that that's the last thing in the world that he would ever do. So everybody else is like, isn't it great? He's finally getting what he deserves. There's this jerk now, and he's in this relationship where he has absolutely no control. And he is, you know, to the point where he's being completely smothered, and it's awesome. And the only one that doesn't like it is Esther, because Esther's saying, I don't like this guy, but he did help me get this job at the comic book store. I kind of owe him. And so she decides she's going to help him. And as she's having that decision for herself, you see the rest of the guys come home one afternoon, and Dean's girlfriend is saying, isn't this great that Dean has asked me to marry him? Isn't this awesome? And you see the look on Dean's face is like, he has no idea what he just did to himself. So he's completely drowning. And everybody else is like super happy about it. But Esther decides that she's going to help him. And what she ends up doing is they're going to have their wedding inside of this World of Warcraft thing, basically. So all of their characters are going to go to a wedding that's happening specifically in the game.
Wow.
And everyone that's invited has to create a character to go into the game. And so you have like Daisy makes herself into a unicorn. You have Susan makes herself into like a hobbit. And they're all these different characters. But Esther decides that when it gets to the point of the wedding where they say, if anybody has any objections, raise your hand, she comes in as a Valkyrie. And basically says, I have a problem with this woman. And in the game, this woman is a cooper. She makes barrels for mead and stuff like that. And she basically says, I have a quarrel with her. It's because of her lousy barrels that a whole bunch of mead was ruined and I lost stature in my community and all this kind of stuff. And she basically challenges her to a fight, beats her, and kills her character. And when she does, you have this woman whose name is Posey. Posey's like, I just respond as a level one fishmonger. Like, I'm not worthy of you anymore. And she gives Dean his ring back and she leaves. So basically Daisy broke them up.
Wow.
As a favor to Dean, because he was in way over his head, and Dean pretends to be furious with her, but he actually is thankful that, that she saved him from getting into a relationship that he would not have been happy in at all. And so that is a great example of sort of the ongoing storyline of these characters and their personalities and the different dynamics that are happening in this second year of school, where the guys are living in one house and the girls are living in the other house, but also a standalone story. This guy has a girl he met online. She comes to visit him. That relationship moves way too fast, and his friends have to step in and basically save him. And so it has this very sort of episodic feel to it, where you could pick up an issue of Giant Days and not have any previous knowledge about any of it. But if you've ever been to college or lived with roommates or been in a relationship that had moved way too fast for you. Like, there's always something relatable about every single story in every single issue that anybody could pick this up. It's very much in some ways to me like an Archie book.
Mm.
Like, you can pick up an Archie book and there's something that's going to click with you. With Giant Days, it's the same thing. It just brings you back to that time when you were in your late teens and early 20s, where you were figuring out stuff for the first time and everything was a new experience and all of these little mundane things were huge things in your life. And it does such a great job of capturing that it really, it's one of my favorite series of all time. And I'm glad that it's lasted this long and I'm glad that it doesn't seem to be showing any signs of slowing down. Because it's a book that everybody should be reading.
Good. Sounds like fun.
I adore it. It's great. So there you go. Those are your new reviews for this week. Now it's time, Matthew, for the Boob Tube and Big Screen Bonanza. And it is time for us to spend our discussion on one area this week, and that is Wonder Woman.
Yes.
I took the entire family to see Wonder Woman on Saturday morning. We went to the noon show. It was the earliest show that they were showing in Enfield on Saturday morning. My wife, not a big superhero fan, but a fan of Wonder Woman. My daughter used to kind of be into comics. It certainly grew up watching Teen Titans and Justice League and all the other stuff that I had on DVD and that we saw on Cartoon Network. So very familiar with superheroes. She was Starfire one year for yep. Halloween. Like, so she's got a little bit of a history with superheroes. My son has more of a history with superheroes, obviously, and then me, who's, you know, certainly the comic book nerd of the family. This was a movie that I was excited about going into, primarily for the reason that I wanted it to reset the DC Cinematic Universe. I was hopeful that from everything that I saw in the previews, this was going to be a movie that had a tone and a sense of optimism that was brighter
yep.
than the other. I wanted it to be more in line with The Flash, with the TV show. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I wanted some of that. I wanted some light in the DC universe. I had no idea that this movie was going to affect me in the way that it did.
I think it's affected a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
Where it's just a typical movie, but you constantly find yourself thinking about it, analyzing things. It's been a while since I've had that movie that has stayed with me a week after I've seen it. It's a week tomorrow since I've seen it. And I am still in my head going through, waiting for people to talk to me about it so I can talk and give my two cents. And the thing about what I thought was really interesting, you were talking about the darkness of the DC universe, the cinematic side, hoping that this would be light. If you think about, they made this a movie of hope in a time when the world was at its bleakest. I mean, you look at World War II. World War II was awful. There were some horrible things going on. But when you look at World War I, World War I was a heinous war. Thousands were dying daily in the trenches.
In trench very warfare. Close quarters and ugly.
Yes.
Yeah.
The scenery, when you think of like No Man's Land was a 5 or 10 mile stretch of that used to be trees and grass that separated the Germans and the French and then the British and the Germans. And it was like apocalypse there. It was, nothing was growing. Everything was dead and gray. But even in that, you got hope. You were very hopeful. It was a very light movie in the face of a very dark time in world history. And I love how they were able to do that.
And what does that tell you, right? It tells you that you can tackle dark subject matter.
Yes.
And really horrific subject matter without losing that sense of hope.
Yeah.
So to me, this was an argument against everyone who says you can't, it has to be dark. It has to be gritty. That's what it requires. Mm-hmm. That's what it doesn't.
No.
It doesn't. Because what you saw in this movie was you saw the very real horrors of war.
Man at their
worst.
I
mean, there are some very emotional and powerful scenes of Diana witnessing the carnage of war. The soldiers coming off the boat
yep.
on stretchers with missing limbs,
yeah.
Looking shell-shocked, seeing very clearly the PTSD that was happening with soldiers as they were coming off, then getting into the battlefields and seeing just the absolute carnage and, you know, the the woman with her child talking about how they just went into the village and all of this horrible stuff happened.
Yes.
And family members are taken away and the kids are being taken away and all this kind of stuff. And then Diana's decision that she's going to do something about that right then and there. Like that whole scene and the way that it played out, so powerful.
Yeah. And I was going to say, without giving – this was a movie that had a huge twist in it as to who the bad guys really were.
Uh-huh.
And who was pulling all the strings in this. So I'm not – we probably shouldn't say who it was, but there is a huge twist in this that I did not even see coming. And one of the – probably my biggest joy out of this whole movie was Christopher Pine's character, who had seen the horrors of war, who knew that this was not fixable by one person. Then you had Wonder Woman. You had Diana's optimism saying, you know what, just let me talk to the bad guy. Let me talk to Ares, because she was assuming because it was a war, Ares was in charge of it.
Right.
And he's trying to explain to her – it isn't that easy.
Well, because she was brought up that that basically Ares was the source of all evil.
Yes.
And that he is the one who corrupts men's hearts to be warlike and to go to war with one another. And that there is this weapon, this sword, this god slayer that, you know, if she can use this weapon, if she can kill Ares, it will – the mankind will no longer be corrupted, and peace will return.
It was like that childlike innocence that she had.
Not, it's the stories that you've been told when you were a kid, right?
I loved that part of the character of Wonder Woman. I thought that she had this innocence that she would say things where you're like, this is like talking to like a 5 or 10 year old child that is so innocent in the world, but then she goes around and takes out 15 soldiers in 30
seconds. I'll tell
you, man,
the whole you know, it's well documented that you and I are big crybabies.
Oh, yeah.
I pretty much cried through this entire movie from like the first 5 seconds all the way through the entire movie, because I was emotional because my wife and daughter are seeing, you know, a hero that they have grown up loving, and especially my wife, like the one hero that she even gives a crap about.
Yeah.
But also the fact that it is – this powerful woman warrior, like you can't ignore what that means.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that piece of it was emotional for me. But as someone who is a lifelong Spider-Man fan, and when the first Spider-Man movie came out with Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, I was just emotionally floored for that entire movie. The things that people point at in that movie and that series from Sam Raimi and say are silly, I have always defended as the movie showing its heart.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty Jenkins has a great quote, and I don't have it here in front of me, but you should look it up on Google, where she basically talks about how the word cheesy is not allowed in her vocabulary, because cheesy is just a way of people having decided at some point that being earnest and being sincere was no longer cool.
Mm.
And at some point that happened in the movies, and it happened with superhero movies, where in order to be good, they had to be edgy. And they couldn't anything that approached being overly emotional or wearing your heart on your sleeve or anything like that was seen as cheesy and over the top. And I remember specifically, especially with Spider-Man 3, when Peter started to sort of show his darker side, how people just destroyed that.
Oh, I hated that movie.
They just destroyed it for that, right? It was so cheesy and it was so blah, blah, blah. And to me, that was the thing I loved the most about the Raimi Spider-Mans was the heart behind it. And especially, man, that first movie, just, it was like, this is what I want. This is what I pictured this to be. And so the way that the first 45 minutes of Wonder Woman goes could be a movie in and of itself.
Yes.
And it just did my heart so good to watch it. Seeing young Diana, I mean, just who reminded me of my niece.
Yes.
But just seeing young Diana and seeing her watching
and mimicking the fight scenes. My heart was so
I was
so happy when I saw that.
It was not just, only happy, but like wow, I was totally like emotional watching that and just seeing how awesome that was. Robin Wright as Antiope.
Yes.
Was amazing. What a fantastic part. You're talking about the Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Now the Amazon warrior.
Yeah.
I want to see a movie with just her.
Yeah.
I want to see a movie where she is leading the army of Themyscira in battle. Mm. I want like a prequel movie now of just that, of like the first time when the Amazonians had to fight for themselves and basically, you know, this place became what it was, Themyscira. Like, I want to see all that because it was amazing. So I love the young Diana stuff. I love, you know, her desire to train. I love the fact that she has been told these stories since she was a kid, but never realizes that she's the God Slayer.
Yes.
That it's not the sword. It's not a weapon. It's her. She is the one. All of that. And then just her own personality and her own conviction, making her into someone who feels this obligation. It's the whole great power and great responsibility thing. She feels this obligation to, something horrible is happening. I have to help. Yes, it's probably awful out in the world of men. You know, yes, you know, these men have come to our shores and killed, you know, some of our sisters here, but I can do something about that. Yep. And I'm going to put a stop to all this. I'm going to do this. Like that whole heroic, you know, duty sort of thing, very, very powerful for me. And I thought that especially that first 45 minutes was basically perfect. There was nothing about, up until the point they leave Themyscira, there is absolutely nothing about that whole first section of that movie that I would do any differently. I thought it was wall to wall amazing.
Yep.
And really overall, I have very few gripes at the movie. I felt like they didn't need the romance between Steve and Diana, although in the comics they have a romance.
Yes.
So I was okay with that. But I liked that they stopped the intimate scene basically at the closing of the door. I don't even know that they needed that.
Yep.
You know what I mean? I think that the scene of them dancing under the snow after they saved the village was enough, right? They could have just walked away with that. I felt like the battle with Ares was a little too Scott Snyder for me.
I see it.
It was Zack Snyder, not Scott Snyder. It was a little too Zack Snyder for me. That felt like his influence on that of, you know, because that was more in line with what the other movies were like. And I thought that everything else that happened with that whole foiling of the plot with Dr. Poison's gas and all that kind of stuff could have worked without it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the reveal of the villain could have been just that.
Yeah.
And he could have disappeared and it could have been that subtle and it could have been fine. You know, and you could have made the case that Diana is going to stay in this world because he's out there and she's going to continue to try to track him down or whatever the case may be. So I didn't think it needed that. That said, I thought that was fine. But those were the only two things of the entire movie that I felt like, it could take that or leave that. The rest of the movie to me was like freaking perfect. The whole no man's land segment. Then she charges into the village and freaking destroys everyone.
Yep.
Just kicks ass all over the place. Some people didn't like the slowing down stuff. I freaking loved it.
I did too. You want to know what the slowing down did for me? This is a war scene. This is a war with bolt action rifles.
Yep.
And when she like busted through the window and all of a sudden she finds herself surrounded by 8 German soldiers. I love the fact that when they slowed it down, to me, it was slowing down what it was really like, because you fired your gun and then you had to cock the bolt back, pull it back, let the bullet eject, wait for the bullet to come up, and then do that slowly. To me, it just made it slow of what everything was. To me, I really loved it, where everything gets speeded up lately with all the fight scenes, where everything's up tight and close.
Yeah.
This was like old James Bond type of fighting, not necessarily slow motion.
Which is my preferred. Full views, I prefer that. Like, I really don't like the quick cut stuff.
Nope, I don't either.
And I thought they did a good balance here. You couldn't tell when it was her, or I couldn't tell when it was her stunt double versus when it was her. By the way, holy crap, there's some great videos of Gal Gadot's stunt double out there training.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
She's a freaking ninja. You should totally track those down. But I also thought in that moment of like slowing it down, like it was capturing the awe of the soldiers who just had this Amazon land in the middle of them with a shield and a sword. And they're just looking at each other like, what the heck?
What just happened? This just is not happened expected. Here.
And before they can, and like as their brain catches up to what is happening in front of them, she's moving again. So it was that whole thing of like your brain almost stops for a second of like, I have to correlate what's actually happening in front of me. And then as soon as your brain catches up of like, oh, I need to do something.
Yep.
She's already in motion and she's kicking the crap out of everybody. The part where she kicks the dude through the window.
Yes.
Like what a exclamation point as he goes flying through the window. Like all of that stuff was just freaking awesome. The part where she's running through that village when everybody else is pinned down and she's just literally charging through with her shield in front yep. of her head and just barreling through like, it's all so good.
Yeah.
It's all good. Like, I loved all of it.
The chemistry between Gal and Chris Pine, I thought was amazing. I thought the two of them had it was a very awkward chemistry. Like, they just weren't all of a sudden, like, into each other and everything fit perfect. I just thought that they were they looked perfect together. They acted perfect yeah. together. I loved everything about the relationships. At the very end with his demise, when she had sort of that revelation flashback of, when they had that communication, when they were talking and the conversation, she couldn't hear.
Right.
Because her ears were ringing. And then all of a sudden she remembered what it was he said.
Yeah.
Or she could hear it now. And that was heartbreaking.
Yes.
With that.
He got to have a great moment in the movie. Etta was fantastic. Yep. There wasn't enough of her.
Yep.
Like I could have done with a lot more Etta in that movie. She was fantastic. And at the end of the day, Gal Gadot just became this part.
Better than
like,
I thought she would be.
She is Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
It's one of those things now where you look at her and like, and then when you see her outside of this movie and you see her talking about what it means to her to see little girls coming up to her and stuff like that. And people ask her questions about what it meant for her to take this role and stuff like that. Like she is the perfect person for this role.
Yep.
She is absolutely perfect. I didn't have questions going in about whether or not she would be a good Wonder Woman. I didn't know her from the Fast and the Furious. I haven't seen those
movies. I never did either.
But she owned that part from the second that she appeared on screen.
Yep.
We kind of knew that. I mean, we talked about this when Batman versus Superman came out, right? She was the best part of that movie. Every scene with her in it was the best part of that movie. Her way the way she handled herself in battle, and she liked, you know, the whole fight scene and stuff like that. Like all of that, we were like, she's perfect.
Yep.
And that was completely reiterated in this movie. Like she is perfect for that role. And it is exactly what the DC cinematic universe needed.
Yep.
To me, it like restores faith in the direction that things are moving forward now. Patty Jenkins has already signed on for Wonder Woman 2.
Good.
Which, if she wants to do every Wonder Woman from here to eternity, sign her to a multi-million dollar, multi-picture deal. Fantastic. Like, just wonderful all around. I loved it. I totally want to go see it again.
Yes.
If I had time this week, I would have gone and seen it again already. It's just great.
I had one problem. It was a silly one.
I'm going to guess before you even say it. It has something to do with the historical accuracy
yes, it did.
Of something with World War I, which the great thing is like I'm totally oblivious to those yep. little snafus, yep. whereas I know you dial right into that.
I'm looking at weapons. I'm looking at uniforms.
Yeah,
I'm looking
exactly,
at everything.
Yep.
And you had the fight scene at the end when she got into the German base.
Yes.
And the bad guy she was fighting threw a tank at her. That was a British tank, not a German tank from World War I. And I said something to my wife and she said, maybe they captured it. And I said, you know what? I'm going to have to just probably go with that.
That's exactly what I would have said.
Because it was not a German tank. It was a British tank.
Right. But that was in the village that they had taken over.
Well, the Germans were there, but the British never got there because they were behind the trenches. Mm. So again, I'm sitting there like, well,
yeah.
the tank didn't go that far. The tank could not have gone that far. They weren't offensive weapons.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I mean, it took a percentage point away from the A-plus movie that I gave it. Still an A-plus.
It was completely an A-plus yes. for me. The only other one thing that I thought was somewhat unnecessary was I loved Dr. Poison.
Yeah.
And I, you know, she came across as just twisted and evil.
Look at the actress who plays her, too. Holy
cow, guy
she's very pretty.
She worked for.
Yeah,
I can't remember what his character's name is. The German commander there. The whole he sniffs the drug and gets stronger thing to me unnecessary. It was them doing that to beef him up for when he had to fight her later on, which was sort of a precursor to the real fight there. So I understood, like, in story terms why they did that, but I didn't think they needed it. But again, small quibbles yep. in an overall amazing movie. Like, I freaking love Wonder Woman.
Now, is that the precursor of the Venom juice?
Right. Well, not in the DC universe. It's not.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean Bane's Venom?
I'm sorry. Yes. Bane's Venom. I'm thinking Venom. Bane's
yeah,
Venom.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what it seemed like, right? Yeah. It seemed like the sort of World War I equivalent of that.
Yep. Like, later on, it got developed to be the Bane juice.
Right. So, but man, what an awesome movie.
Yep.
And just really, really, I'm happy that it was awesome. I'm happy that it had a killer opening weekend. I'm going to be really happy when it kicks the crap out of The Mummy this weekend and continues yes. to be the number one movie, you know, at least in America, because it deserves that. It deserves to have legs. I want it to do amazingly well.
Now, here's my final thought on this. Will Gal get a Oscar nomination for Best Female Lead in a Movie, despite the fact that it is a comic book movie and you're not supposed to take those serious? Because I thought she carried this movie pretty much on her back, and this movie is going to be making triple the money that any other Academy Award nominated movie is going to be. I wonder if this is even going to get any recognition, knowing the answer will be no.
Yeah, that's a good question. One other thing I wanted to mention that is a precursor to us watching the movie. When we went and sat down in the theater, the very first preview that came up on the screen was for Atomic Blonde.
Yes.
Which is the Charlize Theron sort of spy, Cold War spy movie that's coming out at the end of June that it's coming out with James McAvoy's in it as well. John Goodman's in mm-hmm. it. Like, the cast is ridiculously amazing. The trailers look phenomenal. It was very kind of cool to be able to lean over to my wife and say, that is from the book that the guy I do my heavy metal podcast with wrote.
See, I did not realize that.
And she was like, what are you talking about? Anthony Johnston wrote a graphic novel called The Coldest City, and Atomic Blonde is the film adaptation of The Coldest City.
I did not even realize that.
And
wow.
He has already seen it. In fact, they flew him down to South by Southwest when this was being shown. And word on the street is the movie is absolutely as good as the trailers put out there. But that's pretty awesome.
Wow.
So, yeah,
excellent.
You've heard us talk about Anthony forever.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, we've known him for a long time. It's pretty amazing that this movie is poised to kick some real butt this summer. And Charlize Theron, I mean, she is a living weapon in this movie. So
I cannot wait.
It's going to be awesome. And I'm super psyched about that. So, yeah, that was the perfect preview to start the Wonder Woman viewing with and be able to lean over and say, yeah, you know, the guy that dad records early because he lives over in England and, you know, mom thinks he's wasting his time when he's doing his music podcast. That's what he's doing.
Mm.
Granted, none of that affects me at all.
No.
But at least if I'm wasting my time.
You might as well waste it with a guy who makes a movie.
I waste it with a guy who just made a movie.
Yes. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Well, hopefully we haven't wasted your time as we've talked about and gushed about our love for Wonder Woman, because it truly is an awesome movie, at least in our opinion, and everybody should go check that out. We are going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity podcast, but before we do, I want to talk a little bit about the summer reading project, because, as you know, we are reading for our Summer of Dread, the Judge Dredd Case Files Volume 1. It is a very big book. It does not have page numbers, and many of the stories do not have definitive titles for them. So it's kind of hard to say what your homework is going to be and what you should be reading. But if you listen to the last couple episodes, then you know that we have just made it through the Robot Wars storyline. So for the next episode, you want to start with the story that follows that, which is the Brain Blooms story. And then, you know what I'm talking about, Matt.
Oh, I love that. I love
and
that
then
story.
You're going to go through the story with the Floral Wreath Killers. That is what you're going to read for the next episode of Secret Identity. And then for the one after that, you're going to start with the story that begins with the game show You Bet Your Life. And then you're going to go through the story that begins with CompuTel. So those are your next two assignments. So for next episode, Brain Blooms through the Floral Wreath Killers. For the episode after that, You Bet Your Life through CompuTel. So we're just going to kind of take it by case files and come up with titles that kind of describe where you can find them in the book. So that's your next two homework assignments. And then I think probably after that, we'll do our first movie.
Yes, the Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd movie.
Which will be the Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd movie. So if you're just getting involved with the Summer of Dredd, go on Amazon, get the first case files, go to Drive-Thru if you want to get it digitally, get the first the volume of case files and get in here. Because the thing is, most of the case file stories are quick reads.
Yes.
So you can whip off a chunk of them at a time, and you're definitely going to want to do that. So there you go. That's going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. For Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.